Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for the Tech Guy podcast is provided by DSL Extreme. Call 866-2-GET-NET or DSL Extreme. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on the Premier Radio Networks on Sunday, May 18th, 2008. This is show 458. Enjoy. Well, a good day to you. Leo Laporte here, the tech guy, and we are about to talk high tech with you, and I look forward to hearing from you. This is the show where we talk about all that cool stuff that's happening on the internet, whether it's digital cameras, camcorders, MP3 players, cell phones, of course, computers and the internet, Windows and Mac and Linux, anything, Unix, anything, Unix with a U, not an EU, anything you want to talk about on the digital side of the spectrum. We could even talk about biotech and stuff like that. 8888 Ask Leo is the number. That's 888-827-5536. There's certainly a lot to talk about. There always is. I'll mention a few things that are, you know, on the top of my mind right now, but anything that's on your mind, I'd love to hear from you. Have you been following the cyber bully mom story? I talked about this with George Nuri on Coast to Coast a couple of nights ago. It's just a tragedy, and it happened on MySpace. Although, you know, I don't know if this kind of bullying wouldn't happen somewhere else. I think it's easier to do this kind of thing on the internet because you can be anonymous on the internet. Let me tell you the story, and I'd like to get your reaction to it. It's a young girl, 13 years old. Was thought she was having an online romance, kind of a MySpace romance, with a 16-year-old boy named Josh. Back and forth, lots of chatting. About 4 weeks into the relationship, Josh breaks it off and says, meanly, "The world would be a better place without you." 13-year-old girl gets this message, hangs herself, and dies a day later. Turns out there was no Josh. Josh, according to the Department of Justice, which is prosecuting, was really a mom, 49-year-old Lori Drew of O'Fallon, Missouri. Allegedly what happened is that the daughter, Lori's daughter, had a friendship with the girl who killed herself, with a friendship which was broken off, made Lori mad. It's unclear. Some of it looks like maybe Lori's employee started the account. What she's being tried for is providing false information to get a MySpace account and violating MySpace terms to harass and harm other people. The maximum sentence, 20 years in prison. Now, I would hope that the judge and jury would not necessarily apply the maximum sentence. I don't know if that's appropriate. How liable is Lori for her actions on MySpace? She doesn't deny creating the account, by the way. I don't think she does. And certainly it was possible for her to pose as this teenage boy and say mean things. Is she liable for the death of this girl? That's not what she's being tried for. She's being tried for lying on MySpace, which is against MySpace's rules, and for harassing and for bullying behavior. I think a lot of parents will say, oh, that's another reason not to let my kids use MySpace. And I'm not sure that's the right reaction. I think my kids use MySpace. My son is on MySpace. He uses MySpace, and all his friends are on there. It's a social gathering for them. He chats with them every evening. But I have very clear rules with him, and I've talked with him extensively about issues on MySpace. The fact that you don't really know that who you're talking to is who they say they are. So the rule I had for my daughter, who's now on Facebook but was on MySpace, and the rule I have for my son is you may not friend somebody you don't know in real life. and explaining these issues, maybe even showing them this article, so that they understand what's going on here, that adults often pose as kids online, and it's not just MySpace, online, that you can't always be sure that the person is who they say they are. I remember asking Abby when she was younger and using MySpace. I explained all this to her, and I said, now, I hope you're only making friends with people that you know, and you know that people pose. And she said, oh, don't worry about it, Dad. I'm a 33-year-old guy named who lives in New Jersey named Ted. I said, what? I don't use my real. I think she's changed her tune, but at the time she wasn't using, I guess this was on Neopets. It wasn't on MySpace. It was on Neopets. She said, I don't use my real name. I said, good. You never would reveal personal information, not even what school you go to, what town you live in. She said, no. I'm a 38-year-old guy who lives in New Jersey. That showed me that she would, not only did she know that people often pose online, but she's done it herself. It showed me that she had some sense. I discouraged that behavior, but it showed me that she understood very clearly that on the internet, you can be whatever you want to be, and that you shouldn't assume that if you're talking, you think you're talking to a 16-year-old boy, that it is really, in fact, a 16-year-old boy. Is that scaring you, though? Is it making you not want to let your kids be on MySpace? I do, because I think that I let them on it because I think that this is their social life. It drives my wife crazy because Henry will go and sit down and start typing on MySpace. Abby used to do instant messaging. He does MySpace. I think that's what's happened. And she said he spends hours a day on this thing. And I said, well, honey, when you were his age, what did you do when you came home from school? She said, get on the phone. How many hours a night? Till my parents kicked me off because it was the family phone, but could have been hours. So that's what he's doing. He's not on the phone anymore. They don't use the phone anymore. They use MySpace. That's where they get together. That's where they chat with each other. And he's chatting with people he knows. People he goes to school with, kids. Now, we have a couple of things that we do. We also keep the computer in a public space. So we always know what he's using, what he's doing. I can look over his shoulder. I haven't yet asked for his MySpace password. I can see what he's doing online. I could see what his account looks like. But I haven't said, I have to have your password. Do you demand your kids' passwords to online accounts? Do you think that's necessary? There's debate. I'm not saying what I do is the right way. It's the right way for me and my kids. You and your kids may be different. 8888 Ask Leo. That's the number I'd love to talk about. How you use sites like MySpace. I think it's their future. I think that it's cruel and unusual. It's like saying you can't, go to the mall. You can't go to the movies. You can't hang out. I think it's appropriate to prosecute this woman if she did what the Department of Justice alleges. I think it's appropriate. But I don't think it's reason to keep kids off MySpace. It's just one more reason that you should teach your kids what goes on online. I want to tell you, we did this yesterday and it worked really well. There's several ways to interact with the show. The phone number, 888-827-5536. Love to hear from you that way. We have a couple of lines open right now, it looks like. You can also chat with us, irc.dslextreme.com. That's the chat. But the better thing to do is just go to techguylabs.com and click chat. There's a chat link right there on the left. That's the website for the show, techguylabs.com. You'll see show notes there, thanks to Sasha. And the chat room is linked right there. Just click chat. And if you have a chat program, you can use that or you can use the client we provide on that webpage. We also have streaming video, and you can see it in the upper left-hand corner of the show. You can click that to watch it big, or you can go to the streaming videos chat room, which is twitlive.tv. And something I tried yesterday that worked out pretty well, I also want to use something called Twitter, a way that you can send messages, short messages that I can follow, which is great. And Twitter is twitter.com. It's free to join. You do have to join this. I'm sorry. You'd have to join this to use it. But then once you're a member, you can follow me. I'm Leo Laporte on Twitter. Probably if you just type in Laporte, you'll find me. Laporte. It's right up in the top. Just search for my name. Click the follow button under my name, and now you're following. Oh, there's Abby. She's on there, too. And there's a fake Leo Laporte. I'm the one and only Leo Laporte. Don't follow fake Leo Laporte. I don't even know who he is. His bio is, I make money by rambling. Life is good. That could be me. Could be me. I'll have to follow him. So click the follow button underneath. And then when you want to send me a message, you can either do it from the webpage at Twitter, Just put an at sign in my name, at Leo Laporte, and then you have 140 characters to send me a short message. And I'm following all those messages right now. You can even do it via SMS, via your cell phone. Once you sign up for Twitter, you can register your cell phone with it. And then the short code is 40404. Put at Leo Laporte in your message, and I will be reading those Twitter messages on the show as well. So it's one more way we can follow you. And you could participate in the conversation. Because I think that's kind of part of the fun of this. 8888 Ask Leo. That's the number. 888-827-5536. Or go to Tech Guy Labs. I explain how to do this Twitter thing at Tech Guy Labs. We could talk about that. Yahoo's back at the Yahoo Microsoft thing. This is endless. Back in the news. Investor Carl Icahn has now nominated a new board of directors. And has gone to the stockholders saying, look, we could have had more money. We could have made some money on this thing if the stupid board of directors at Yahoo had just gone along with the plan and sold to Microsoft. So Icahn saying, look, vote for a new board of directors, including, by the way, Mark Cuban, who is a billionaire thanks to Yahoo, because Yahoo bought his company, Broadcast.com, totally overpaid for it, $5 billion. It turned out to be worthless. He's biting the hand that feeds him. He's saying, I'll be on the board. I'll sell to Microsoft. Well, here's the good news. Yahoo's stock since the Microsoft attempt to take over has gone up so much that it almost proves what Yahoo's board and owners were saying. Look, we're worth more than Microsoft's offering. Give us a chance. The stock has been going up. Microsoft's stock has not. In fact, there's an interesting article in the New York Times today by Randall Stosser, who's a business professor at San Jose State, and who, in my opinion, writes the best analysis of what's going on in Silicon Valley of anybody. He follows it. He's there, but he also knows business. He says it, and I think this is true. There's a jinx in the tech industry. Companies can't always stay on top, and Microsoft's time is done. What do you think? Let's talk about it. I am Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy, 8888 Ask Leo is the number, or Twitter me or chat me, but we're following you on a variety of different media. It's kind of the ultimate multimedia experience. 8888 Ask Leo, though, is the best way, and that's where Austin is from Los Angeles. Hey, Austin, Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy.
Hey, Leo, I had a quick question for you. I was curious, certainly, what's the story with the new BlackBerry and how's that going to compare to the new iPhone?
Well, I have to, disclaimer up front, I don't have it yet. So I'm talking from, you know, pictures I've seen. There was PC Magazine had a hands-on review. They got a copy of it. I'm very impressed by it. It's called the Bold, or the BlackBerry 9000. It will, I have to tell you, the current BlackBerry gives the iPhone a good run for the money. So the Bold is certainly going to give them a run for the money. It's very attractive. It's got an updated operating system and user interface, which is very much more modern. That's one thing that people complain about with the BlackBerry. It kind of looks old-fashioned.
Right, right.
I like the BlackBerry. And the reason I use a BlackBerry, for a couple of reasons. One, it has a real keyboard. And I tried for the longest time to use the touch screen on the iPhone. I just never had any good results with it. And it's so much easier to use a real keyboard. You know, the touch screen is fine if you don't do a lot of data entry, but if you're typing a lot of messages or texts or whatever, I like having a keyboard. Maybe it's just me. Maybe I'm an old man. I don't know. The other thing I really like about the BlackBerry, and I think is very important, is the ability to add third-party applications. There's a lot of third-party software I use on the BlackBerry that I couldn't add to the iPhone. Now, that's going to change next month when the iPhone finally allows third-party software. We'll see, you know, how much that changes. But I think the BlackBerry Bold is a very nice BlackBerry. You bet I'll buy one the minute I can. Like they're going to offer it. It's not going to be an exclusive for any one carrier, which is good news. They're going to offer it on most of the carriers. It will support the new HSDPA standard. So that means if you're using AT&T or T-Mobile, you'll be able to finally get high-speed 3G networking out of it. I like it. I think they've done a very nice job. RIM is the one company that seems to be giving an iPhone a run for its money.
Wow. Any time frame for when that might come out?
I think it's fairly soon in the next month or so. I didn't see a time or a date. They're showing them to people now, which means they're in production. Who's your carrier? That's the real question.
AT&T.
Yeah. So AT&T is going to be a little busy with the iPhone for the next month. In fact, they halted all vacations for their employees June 9th through 17th. Usually a hint that they expect a lot of sales. So I think they'll be a little busy. They probably don't want to eclipse the iPhone launch. The new iPhone is going to come out, we predict, June 9th. However, I think it won't be too long before AT&T offers the Bold. Let me see if I can get a ship date. You know, usually they're pretty cagey on those. Let me see if anybody is. It's the 9,000. Yeah, no hard launch date, no hard price yet, as far as I can tell from anybody. It's a bigger display, 480 by 320, which is fantastic. It's got a much faster processor. They put a 625 megahertz processor in there. It needed it. The BlackBerry's been a little slow. A gigabyte of internal memory. Of course, you can add those micro flash cards, the micro SDHC in there. It has Bluetooth, too. It supports stereo, so it will be a good playback device for audio, for music. It has video recording, which previous BlackBerries have not. Built-in photo geotagging. I mean, there's a lot to say about it. I think it's a pretty darn exciting platform. I'm a BlackBerry fan. it's the first time they've updated it in 2 years since the Curve. It's a major update. I don't know when it'll be available, and when it'll be available to the companies, to the phone companies, as carriers, is one thing. When they'll make it available to you is in another entirely. So what you just got to do is stay on AT&T. Usually it takes a few months. I'm betting, you know, it's going to be September, August or September before you'll see it. Oh, another thing they've added, which I think is great, is Documents to Go. This is part of the new BlackBerry OS 4.6. That means you'll now be able to read and edit Word and PowerPoint documents. You'll be able to read Excel spreadsheets, for some reason not edit them. I don't know why that is. But the ability to read these Microsoft Office documents has been very important. It's one of the reasons people go to Windows Mobile. I don't think Windows Mobile is a very good platform. A lot of people, use it mostly because they need to integrate with Windows. Matt, Chicago, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hey, Matt, how are you? Welcome to the show.
Hey, Leo, how are you?
Fantastic.
Good. Hey, is it possible for one of these data recovery expert companies to not be able to recover anything from a hard drive?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Have you lost something and you're trying to get it back?
Well, pretty much, but it's not like critical. I just wanted to know if it's possible they weren't able to recover anything. Now, where do they get that equipment from? Like, how does somebody start up a company like that?
A lot of money. So there's two different ways a hard drive, you can lose data on a hard drive. One is a soft error. Formatting went wrong. You accidentally formatted the drive. You erased files you didn't mean to erase. Maybe the power went out and the drive head went right across the drive and just wrote a lot of garbage across it. Those are soft errors. Those can often be fixed in software.
Right.
So that's why unerase programs work or SpinWrite works. But if there are physical errors, if there's a big gouge out of the disk, if the drive platters are frozen, the bearings froze up, if the head got bent,
right,
if it got in a fire, those are physical errors. So these companies like Drive Savers have clean rooms. You have to have a clean room, an absolutely dust-free environment, people in bunny suits, where they can open it up. You cannot open a hard drive in plain air.
Yeah.
Those little balls of dust are boulders on a hard drive because the head just flies, you know, nanometers above the disk. So they do it in a clean room environment. What they have often is every drive mechanism. They'll take your platter out, put it in a working drive mechanism. There's stuff they can do in that clean room that you couldn't do at home. That's why it's thousands of bucks. And can it fail? You bet. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. This portion of the Tech Guy is brought to you by my friends at Carbonite.com. Secure, fast, easy backup over the internet. They save my data every day. They should be saving you yours for a free trial. Visit Carbonite.com. And don't forget to mention me, Leo. 8888 Ask Leo is the number. A couple of questions coming in via Twitter. Again, I'm at Leo Laporte on Twitter. Big in Virginia, Kevin asks, I have a one-year-old MacBook with 2 gigs of RAM. Is it worth bumping it up to more? You know, OS X, the operating system that Apple uses, really loves memory. And one of the ways I think you can get a Mac faster is by putting more memory. I now put, as a routine, 4 gigabytes in all my Macs. And I think with the desktops where I can go higher than 4 gigs, I'm probably going to put 6 or 8 gigs. Now, do you need it? It depends on what you do. If you use Photoshop, that uses a lot of memory. If you run multiple programs simultaneously, or Final Cut, or you know, those big heavy programs, a lot of memory helps. But in general, computers benefit from lots of memory because our programs are so big and the operating systems are so big nowadays. They'll fill up, you know, 1 gig of RAM easy. They'll fill up 2 gigs of RAM easy. And the reason that slows them down is when the RAM fills up, when the memory fills up, they start going to the page file, the swap file. They start using the hard drive as pretend RAM, and your hard drive is thousands of times slower than your memory. So your computer slows down commensurately. So it's always better to have more RAM. The question is, what's the sweet spot? I think on both Windows Vista and OS X, I'd max it at 4. If you can get up to 4 gigabytes, I'd go to 4. RAM is cheap now. That's the other thing, is don't buy RAM from the expensive vendors. Apple overcharges. Dell overcharges. Go to a third party, Crucial.com, Kingston.com. For Mac RAM, I go to MacSales.com. That's Otherworld Computing. And another, putting 4 gigs in your system is about $100. For $100, that's a big, big improvement. Let's go to Robert in San Diego, California, our next caller. Hi, Robert. Leo Laporte, the Hi. Tech Guy.
Hi, Leo. First, I'd like to say I don't have any computer problems. Thank you very much to you. I'm calling on something completely different.
That's good.
Yeah, Macs and PCs are all running smooth here, and thanks a lot. I listen to you a lot, and you've helped me out tremendously.
Thank you, Robert.
To find out more about cell phone applications. I can't find anything, really, how to build them. I have a young daughter. Well, she's 20. She's a senior at UCSD. She's very sharp. And she was trying to help generate some revenues to finish their schooling, and she and her mom put together these very useful little phrase guides, how to quickly speak Spanish or how to quickly speak English.
Oh, that's neat. Yeah.
She built a website, speakenglishonthejob.com, and the Department of Education was the first entity to purchase, and they're buying now all over the nation. And I'm thinking, you know, maybe there's a way to repurpose this content. It's text-based and turn it into a cell phone app that people can download.
That's an excellent idea.
But I can't...
That's an excellent idea.
I've been in Europe recently, and there's lots of cell phone apps over there you can get. I'll be darned if I can even find the front door here.
Well, first of all, it depends on... This is the problem in the States, not just with applications, but the reason text messaging took so long to take off. A variety of technologies haven't come to the States because we have multiple cell phone systems. You go overseas, they have one system. They have GSM. All the phones talk to each other. All the text messaging talks to each other. Now, what's happened is... There are different ways to write applications for cell phones. So you have to kind of say, well, who am I writing for? You write for BlackBerry, you write for Windows Mobile, you write for an iPhone. That's three different applications. Many of them are written in Java. If you wanted to write a phone application that would play on the most platforms, Nokia, Motorola, BlackBerries, Java is a very good start. Now, you're not going to do this yourself. You're going to hire somebody to do this.
Yeah, that was the idea. I mean, I was thinking perhaps there's a way to have this developed and then maybe either have it downloaded on a website or maybe try and contact the cell phone carriers and see if they would pay us a royalty for the downloads.
Right.
But, you know, it's extremely useful, and it's just text-based, but it's written brilliantly, and all you have to do is search a keyword, and boom, there's the word in front of you. And this is written in the trades, for the trades, so any contractor or anybody in the hotel industry or, you know,
Great idea. Even
people who speak no English can quickly learn how to speak Spanish and English, sorry. And that's why the Department of Education has been buying these in bundles and boxes. So how would I go about? Is there a
Well, one thing about distribution is there are sites like Handango, Handango, where people go to buy their applications. Handango, in fact, has a downloadable store that you could put on a cell phone and buy applications. It works for BlackBerry, Windows Mobile, I think and Nokia S60 as well, the major cell phone platforms. And now there's a third or fourth platform that's very, very important, becoming more important all the time. This is Apple's iPhone. If you develop for the iPhone, and there are a lot of people who are able to do this now because Apple put out the kit to do that. They call it an SDK, a software developer's kit, in January. Next month, in fact, just a couple of weeks off, they're going to introduce the iPhone store. Well, very much like the Handango store, you'll be able to buy applications on your iPhone. The problem is you develop for the iPhone, you're not developing in Java. You're developing in Cocoa. You're developing it like a Mac application, and it's only for the iPhone. So the guy who can do your Java version isn't going to be able to do your iPhone version.
Is there a development community where I could put out a request for quote or anything like that that you know of?
Yeah, there is. There's a place where freelancers gather. I mean, there are many places. Let's put it this way. There are many places you can do this. One of them is called Elance, and I think this is probably the biggest programmer's haven.
Elance is freelance, but Elance?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. ELANCE.com.
Okay.
They do programming, they do design, multimedia, they do a lot of other stuff, but a lot of programmers hang out on Elance. There may be others, and if you're a programmer and you're listening and you have a suggestion, you could Twitter me or you can chat, mention it in the chat room or call 8888-ASK-LEO, and I'll pass that along. Are you selling this stuff online now, Robert?
Yeah, they put together a little website. As I said, I hope you don't mind me saying it, but it's Speak.
I want you to plug it, please. What is it?
SpeakEnglishOnTheJob.com. And they're pocket guides. The hardware stores are selling them, but
I love the site.
It's amazing.
So you outsource that, obviously. I mean, this is very nicely done.
No. This is all done.
Really?
This is a family effort. Just to, you know,
well, that's beautiful. It's a very nice site.
Put all the kids through school, and you know they're generating, sort of self-generating. She's a straight-A student, and just taking her wits and some paper and you know some computer apps. We did it all here in the house.
I'm so impressed.
I noticed there, Bill Handelin interviewed her as well. He's just very, very happy to learn about her, and it's on the site there somewhere.
Boy, I wish my kids were a little more enterprising. I wish more people were enterprising like this. What a great solution. Need money for college? Let me think, what can I do? And here it is. And thanks to the internet, you could find an audience for this stuff. And
yep.
I think that's great,
yep,
too.
Yep. Well, thank you again. And again, my computers, thank you for running so smoothly. Thanks for all your input.
You're welcome, Robert.
Take care.
It's SpeakEnglishOnTheJob.com. And yeah, Elance, I think, is where most of the programmers I know will go there to look for. You know, there's other stuff like Craigslist and stuff, but you want to kind of go where everybody goes. And Elance seems to be the place for freelance programmers, designers, copywriters, that digital folk go there to get jobs. And it's kind of got a neat system where you bid for jobs and stuff like that. You can find people. It's tough finding a programmer, though. It's hard if you're not a technical person to vet them. How do you know if they're good? Ask them for stuff they've done. You know, make sure you get referrals. Make sure you talk to previous customers. Because, you know, anybody can hang out a shingle and say, I'm a programmer. You want somebody who can not only do the job, but do it in a timely fashion. Nightwing on Twitter saying codeguru.com is another place. Codeguru.com. And Mr. Glass recommends Rent-A-Coder. This Twitter's working out great. That's great. Rent-A-Coder. Thank you, Mr. Glass. Thank you, Nightwing. Twit Commander says Java, definitely the way to go. And I think if you're going to pick one platform for cell phone development, certainly Java is the most common, the most popular. But it is limiting. You know, always better to write for the, you know, if you're going to write for the platform, you write for Windows Mobile in Windows. You write for the BlackBerry in BlackBerry. You write for the iPhone in iPhone. I think if I were to pick one platform right now, I would develop for the iPhone because you're going to get a beautiful interface. There's going to be a lot of interest in iPhone apps starting June 9th. You know, there's going to be a huge instant marketplace and a lot of iPhone users. There's some several million iPhone users out there right now. And there won't be that many applications initially. You start making for Windows Mobile or BlackBerry, you're competing against, you know, 3, 5, 7 years worth of programming efforts, lots of applications, some good, some bad. Apple's going to vet every application that goes on the iPhone. So in general, I think iPhone apps will be a much higher quality. If I were going to pick one platform, I'd make it the iPhone. Mary and Salinas. Hi, Mary. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Mary, are you there? Hi, Mary.
Hello.
Hey, welcome to the show. Thanks for
hanging on. Hey, Leo, how are you?
I'm great.
Listening
on the great KGO, right?
Yep. That's my station. I'm in that area, so I get to listen to KGO.
Great station.
Boy, I could talk to you all day. I wish you were my neighbor, and then we could just
move to Petaluma.
Yeah, we could fix all this stuff. First of all, I want to say I'm a longtime listener. I love your show and the website, and I've been watching
you
set up your studio. That's been pretty entertaining.
Isn't this fun?
Yeah, good for you.
Crazy.
Also, I've just crossed over to the dark side. I bought myself a Mac, and some of my friends are appalled, but I'm working on that, and that's going great.
I think you're going to be happy, Mary.
Yeah, oh, I'm real happy.
Yeah.
You know, that whole thing where they say it just works, well, you take it out of the box and off it goes.
Yeah.
I have a couple questions, but I want to make one quick comment, what you're talking about at the beginning of the hour about kids and computers.
Yeah, the MySpace debacle.
Well, not just that, but I do a lot of work for friends. I just help people. I'm kind of everybody's go-to person. When they mess everything up, I fix it for them.
Right on.
And I got to tell you, I'm absolutely appalled at how clueless some people that I think are really good people and really good parents, and, you know, I go over to their house, and their 15-year-old kid is looking at porn and not doing his homework, and they have absolutely no clue. So I
don't put the computer in the kid's bedroom. Put it in the living room.
Yeah, I don't have kids, so I can't comment about parents.
That works, because they're not going to surf porn while they're walking back and forth to the kitchen.
I have seen some really strange things that kids are doing on computers and their parents.
It's sad because they have access now to stuff that we as kids did not have access to. I mean, awful, evil stuff. And you know what? You can't stop it. They're going to go to friends' houses and do it because they're going to have a friend who's not supervised. You have to talk to them. You have to explain what's out there. You have to say, this stuff gets in your brain. It never gets out of your brain. I know you're going to be tempted. You're going to want to do this. But it's teaching bad values. Here are our values. Here's how we think women should be treated. That kind of thing.
Yeah, it's hard for me because I have friends that I really care about, and I have to say, you know, I really don't know how to tell you this, but you need to look at this stuff.
Tell them, though. They need to know that.
Yeah. So here's...
You're not snitching out the kids. Hey, hang on. Let's finish this conversation because I want to talk more with you. Let's just pretend we're neighbors, okay?
Okay.
Hang on, Mary. Leah Laporte. I am the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888 Ask Leo. Corey on Twitter says, if your computer isn't in a public place, if it's not in a public place, kids will tend to want to do things they shouldn't. My son, my 13-year-old, says, please let me have a computer in my room. I said, never, never. Now, my daughter, who this is an interesting conundrum. The high school she goes to, you get a laptop. So, I mean, she's going to bring that up to her room. Now, at this point, she's older, and I trust her, and I don't have any. I know we're not having any problems with her. So, when it gets to that point, then it's another issue. I do a parenting podcast called Jumping Monkeys, and we interviewed Jennifer Granick, who's a director. She's a lawyer, privacy lawyer, and she's at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and so she's big on privacy. And I said, now her kids are little. They're 6 months old twins. I said, when they get to be teenagers, will you spy on them? Will you monitor their internet access? Will you ask for passwords to their websites? Will you read their email? She said, no, privacy. It's easy, but I have to say, I think it's easy to say that until you come up against it. It's tough being a parent of a teenager. And sometimes those tools can help you. We're talking to Marion Salinas, who says she sees things on her friends' computers. She's appalled and embarrassed. But, you know, I think you're right to tell the parents.
Well, I'll tell you, I'm not embarrassed, but they should be embarrassed. And also, I have a lot of neighbors that don't understand about securing their networks.
Gosh. Tell me about that.
I call them up and I tell them, I said, I'll come over and fix it for you for free. And they don't want to know. Here's my shopping question.
Really?
I've got a case of the Iwanas, unfortunately. So I got the Mac taken care of. Two things. I really would like to get an MP3 player. I love the iPod Touch. But here's a couple things. It doesn't have FM, and you can get all the aftermarket adapters and all that. What I would like is an MP3 player that has Wi-Fi and FM and that. So between Zune and iPod and Sony and SanDisk and SANSA, I could drive myself crazy, or I could just ask you, you got any ideas?
You know, I like the Zune, believe it or not, people are going to laugh when I say this, but I like the Zune a lot. The new Zune does have those features. The negative on the Zune is that, you know, it's a different copy protection scheme. So have you already bought stuff on the iTunes store?
No.
Okay,
no.
So you're starting from scratch. Do you have records that you've digitized already? Or
oh, yeah, I've got tons of stuff. But,
okay.
You know,
so you're
I would like to put MP3s on something, but where I live, there's some really good FM stations. So if I'm just out walking around, it's nice sometimes to catch certain programs.
I would go with the Zune. I mean, you know, Creative Zen is very good, but here's a couple of things I like about the Zune. First of all, it's a great screen. It's got a great interface for FM radio. All of these have trouble as a receiver. You know, they usually use the headphones as an antenna, so you're going to want to wear the headphones. Mm-hmm. The movie playback on the bigger screen Zunes is fantastic. If you ever want to watch video, the negative is you have to buy music from the Zune store if you're going to buy music online. Now, if you're sticking with stuff that you've got from your own collection that you've ripped as MP3s, no problem, no problem at all. I actually like the Zune store if you don't have any purchase music, because they have a all-you-can-eat month-by-month plan. So you pay, I can't remember what it is, $10-$15 a month. And anything on the store you could put on your Zune.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a really good solution.
That's kind of scary. I'm back in Microsoft land. Here's the last question.
I know. But you're a Mac user. There's one problem.
I use Linux. I use Mac. I use PC.
Okay.
I use all.
You'll have to use Windows to manage your Zune.
Okay. I can do that. One last question. I'm taking up so much of your time here, but... I do need a new router now. I've been looking at the Apple routers just because they're Apple.
No, don't get an Apple router. They're more expensive. Yeah.
What is the deal with, you could drive yourself wireless in and draft in? Is there a standard yet, or has that not happened?
There's not a standard.
Okay.
The standard is held up. N is, of course, the newest form of 802.11 Wi-Fi. And it is much better, farther range. I mean, we're talking twice as far or more, you know, 300 feet or more. It has much higher speeds. You're talking, probably real usable speeds in the 50 megabit range. So it's even good for copying files from computer to computer. Now, the drawback is there is no standard. We keep saying there's going to be a standard. There's been a little bit of a fight between the chipset manufacturers that one of them is saying the other system, there's two systems, the draft system is using a system that is going to have interference problems and on and on and on, and it's just really been a problem. I recommend if you're going to go, and we just bought a router, we bought the Linksys N. There are two companies that use the Ergo chipset, which in my opinion is the best N chipset, and that's Belkin or Linksys. So I'm going to recommend, I'm holding up the Linksys right now, so if you're looking at the camera, you can see it.
Is that the N or a draft N, or what are they calling it?
It's all draft. Nothing is yet finalized.
Okay.
Draft is very close to final. You know, there was the pre-release, and then there was the draft. There isn't a final yet, but most of these manufacturers say, well, draft is so close to final that when the final comes out, it'll be a little firmware upgrade and you'll be set.
So you bought a Linksys and you're using that with what, PC and Mac?
Yep.
And you're happy?
Yep. Easier to configure these with a PC. As long as you've got a Windows machine, it's a snap. You can't use the Mac software to configure it. The Mac software is pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm.
They make it very easy to set up an 802.11 Wi-Fi router.
Mm-hmm.
But you're a Windows person. You're savvy.
Yeah, I've got about a 5-year-old Belkin that's held up real well, but it's kind of dying on me.
I like those Belkin Ns a lot.
Well, I've had a good Belkin G for 5 years. It's been great, but I'd like to upgrade.
Belkin quality varies because they don't make anything, right? They take OEM, another manufacturer's stuff, label it. So you don't know, but I can tell you the Belkin N routers have been very, very good. I don't know who's making them for them, but they're very well made. And I think these Linksys are very good. I have mixed feelings about Linksys. Look, they invented it. They're owned by Cisco. That's the biggest company in networking. The problem, I think, with Linksys is they became very, very popular. They started cranking out millions of these, and the quality went down a little bit. I think they've turned that around, but you'll hear a lot of tales about Linksys's dying.
Leo, listen, like I said, I wish you were my neighbor and we could have a couple of cold margaritas.
Come on
and
up.
Talk about all this stuff. So thank you for your time and your great.
Nice to meet you, Mary. Thank
Bye-bye.
You so much. I really appreciate it. You can watch our video at twitlive.tv. It's not the whole show, though. You've got to listen to the radio so that you can hear the callers. But the video of me making faces and stuff is available at twitlive.tv. There's a little chat room there, or join our chat room, our the same one we've been using for years, at irc.dslextreme.com. In fact, it's all linked. Easiest thing to do, it's all linked on my website for the show, techguylabs.com. More of your calls to come. I am Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. A good day to you. Leo Laporte here. I am the Tech Guy, and we are talking high tech, everything digital. I should call this the Everything Digital Show. I mean, computers, the internet, cell phones, MP3 players, home theater. We talk about it all. If it's got a chip in it, I want you to call me and ask about it, or tell me about it. Solutions are just as welcome as problems. 8888, Ask Leo's a number. That's 888-827-5536. Our website is techguylabs.com. So if you hear something on the show and you can't remember it, you don't have to write it down if you're driving. Just go to the website later, techguylabs, all one word, .com. We're also taking questions via chat. That's irc.dslextreme.com. But you don't have to write that down. That's linked on the Tech Guy Labs site. We've got video going on the Tech Guy Labs site, also at twitlive.tv. And I'm taking questions on Twitter, too, which is something we started this weekend, and that's working pretty well. Got a lot of great questions, suggestions. So if you're a Twitter member, just my handle on Twitter is Leo Laporte. Just send a message to me @Leo Laporte, all one word, @LEOLAPORTE, and put your message on there, and I'll see that because I'm monitoring that. It's a good way to give me feedback or questions or anything you'd like to do. In fact, somebody just sent me one. Let me scroll back a little bit. Wanting to know their Palm TX died. Oh, well, that was a great Palm device. Probably the classic, the best Palm device, the TX, I thought. In fact, my friend Steve Gibson bought 4 or 5 of them when they came out, and I think he still has them in his freezer. He keeps them in the freezer. So they won't go bad. I don't know. He thinks it helps the batteries last longer. He keeps it in the freezer, and he has 4 or 5 of them. But our questioner says, should I get an iPod Touch to replace it? You know, if you're used to the Palm and the ability to add third-party software and a great variety of it, too, you might be a little frustrated with the iPod Touch. Yeah, there's some great things about the iPod Touch. It has Wi-Fi. So if you're in a lot, you know, when I'm at home, I've got Wi-Fi. When I'm at work, I've got Wi-Fi. Pretty much everywhere I go, I can get on a Wi-Fi network. That means I can use the Safari browser. I can do a lot of browser-based stuff. But right now, the Touch will be a little frustrating for Palm users. All going to change in 2 weeks. Because when the iPhone store comes out, the iPod Touch will also get benefit of all of those applications that work on the iPhone or the iPod Touch. Then the Touch might start being really a compelling platform. Better in many ways than a Palm because it's got the touch screen. It's got the, you know, kind of the cool touch gestures you can use. And it has accelerometers in it that can sense its position in space. So it's going to be a very interesting gaming platform. In fact, I understand they're going to have Spore, which is going to be the hot game. They're going to have Spore out for it. So I think a Touch is maybe not yet a Palm replacement. It's not yet quite a, you know, portable computer, but it's very darn close. And I think when you see what happens in 2 weeks when they add those applications, you might want to wait till then. I wouldn't get a Palm anymore, I have to say. It's sad. I'm a big Palm fan. I think the Palm is pretty much history. Cameron says, I'm looking for a laptop for college. Should I get a MacBook or an HP tablet? Oh, that's a good question. They both have lots to recommend. I'm a MacBook fan. That's what I use kind of day to day. And if you're going to a college where Macintoshes are prevalent or where you feel like, you know, it'll be a benefit to have a Mac, I'd certainly recommend it. But there are some nice things about a tablet. I have an HP tablet right in front of me here, too. I have both a MacBook and an HP tablet. This is an older HP tablet, the 4200. The nice thing about a tablet for a college kid is you can flip around the lid, use the pen, and take notes just as if you were writing in a notebook. So I think that's kind of cool. And it has decent, not great, but decent handwriting recognition. You can surf that way. I think a lot of professors would prefer kids did not have laptops in class. In fact, I saw lately a number of professors are starting to ban laptops. They said, it's like I don't have your attention. Kids are busy texting and so forth. But if you're sitting there with a notebook like this and taking notes like that, it doesn't really feel like a laptop, does it? It's really like a notebook. You're writing on it. So I think that for college, a tablet might be compelling. It's hard to know whether it's going to work for you. Some people love them and some people hate them. I got a tablet because I was curious. I really wanted to know more about the platform. And I didn't become a big tablet user, but I know people who are major tablet fans. So I would suggest, if you can, trying a tablet for as long as you can. It might be the perfect, I have to say, it might be the perfect computer for you, for college especially. You know, in general, I think a MacBook is a good choice for almost anybody. But that lack of the ability to write on the screen and take notes in a kind of more natural way, I think that could be a selling point. Chris is on the line. DVD Chris from Round Rock, Texas. Hey, DVD Chris.
Hello, Leo.
You work for Dell?
No, I work for a different company that we're not going to name today.
Okay, because isn't Round Rock where Dell is?
Yes, it sure is. Got the plant here and the Dell campus, and
that's right.
Dell's big in Round Rock.
But not the only tech firm.
Apparently not. Well, I don't really work for a tech firm.
I work
for a chain of retail stores.
Got it.
And it's great to talk to you again. I talked to you several months back on the phone. Met you at Blog World, so that was great.
Oh, yeah, I remember. Yeah, of course.
Yeah. We were in that room answering those questions. So what I am charged with doing is setting up a system of HD flat panel monitors in our retail stores.
Oh, and it's your job, huh?
Oh, I know.
A system of flat panel monitors. So you see that. You'll go into a store. We were just at Costco yesterday, and they have all the monitors hooked up, and they're all feeding a single signal to all of them.
Exactly. And that is pretty much exactly what we want to do.
Isn't there a kind of a standard way to do that?
Well, that
I mean, every store does it.
I was calling you. When you want to distribute an HD signal to multiple sets, apparently there's a whole new range of issues that comes into play. I suppose my choices then are HDMI, component video, and distributing HDMI apparently is not, number one, not very cheap, and there's apparently some kind of reliability issues on that. I was wanting to get your recommendations on what we might be able to do. I've been looking at the different ways to distribute. So do you have any ideas on that?
I am not an expert on this. You know, I've never had to do this. I think the couple of issues, you know, if you want to do premium content, you're going to have to use HDMI, and you want those screens to look as good as they can. So sending an S video or a component is not going to be as desirable as sending HDMI to each of these.
Right. There's one thing where you're not going to be feeding HD content to the TV.
Ah.
It's basically being an up-converting DVD player. So it's really going to be more like 480i content that's actually being displayed.
Oh, that's interesting.
Copyrighted content.
Now, will all the TVs have DVI? Well, I guess it doesn't matter. If they have HDMI, you can convert the DVI.
Okay.
I would look at, there's a company called Magenta Research.
Okay.
It's my understanding that this is what people use when they need to do many monitors. And they sell boxes. They have two ways of doing it. You can actually do it over Ethernet, which gives you a longer throw. So let's say the source is in the back of the store and the TVs are in the front. You could do Cat 5.
Cat 5 cable is much cheaper to
Much cheaper. Yeah, and has longer, and you can do a much longer distance.
That was something I came across, was there is apparently some way to change the video to Cat 5.
Right. This supports DVI. It supports, in other words, high quality. I would take a look at them. I mean, these are the high-end. I think this is the high-end thing that people use at trade shows. I imagine this is what, you know, big stores use, big box stores and so forth. This is the company that seems to have the kind of the lock on this stuff. And they do have DVI as well as Cat 5. So it's magenta-research.com. Okay.
Excellent. And if anybody has any suggestions, I am DC Chris on Twitter. If anybody just wants to tweet, anybody that's a professional installer or has some type of inside idea of
that would be great. So it's @DVDChris.
Mm-hmm.
One word. Great. Yes. I'm kind of enjoying using Twitter for this. This has really given me a lot more feedback and interactivity, and I think this is kind of cool.
Yeah.
Not to mention that if I can get more people to follow me, Kevin Rose won't beat me as the number one Twitter user.
We're going to be
more
talking about that again this week.
It's endless.
It's endless. I don't want to talk about Twitter anymore.
Enough of that. Enough Twitter. Hey, thank you, Chris. I really appreciate
thank
it. Good luck. And Magenta Research is one place. But if you use this kind of stuff, I'd love to hear from you. Or you can Twitter our friend DVD Chris. It's @DVDChris, of course. Let's see. 8888 Ask Leo's a phone. Fred is on the line from Panama City, Florida. Hi, Fred. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hello, Leo.
Hey.
I have a Mac, and I am looking for some type of shareware or some type of application for a bill pay reminder that might interface with iCal.
So you want it to kind of automatically remind you that you better pay that bill, Fred, or you're cap power is going to be cut off or something like that.
You got it. Exactly.
There's a lot of web-based. I would do it via the web.
Okay.
There's a lot of web-based solutions that will do this. There's a lot of web-based reminder solutions. There are calendar-based ones. I use one called Remember the Milk, which I would highly recommend. Absolutely free. rmilk.com.
Okay.
And it's a to-do list and a reminder system that will integrate with iCal. So what you can do is subscribe to your to-do list via iCal. You can actually put in reminders. So iCal will go, bleep, 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 it's time to pay the bill. But I use it. It's much more flexible than just bill paying. I mean, I use it to keep track of all the things I have to do. It'll email me. It'll text me. Or it'll let me know via iCal when I have to do something. And it's free. rmilk.com. Thanks, Fred. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888 Ask Leo. That's the number to call if you want to talk about high tech. James is in Baltimore, or should I say Balmer. Hey, James, Leo Laporte here.
Hey, what's up, Leo?
Not much. How are things in Balmer? You get a nice weather yet?
It's a little bit rainy today. It's not horrible.
Oh, I'm sorry. Love that town.
Hey, I don't really have a problem. It's just an irritant. I use Mac and Linux, Ubuntu, and I want a like a network attached storage that can use both, but that isn't like $1,000. Any suggestions?
Well, that's the last thing you said is a tough one. Almost all network attached storage is independent of the operating system, so they just show up as Windows shares or Mac shares or Linux shares. That's not too much because they all use Samba, which is kind of it's originally Windows LAN Manager, but everybody understands it, everybody works with it, so it's not a big problem. Getting the price down is another issue. One thing you might look at. See, what happens is these aren't so expensive until you add the disks. The one I bought was about $800 for a terabyte. So that's kind of in your price range. And I really love it. It's from Netgear Bottom. It's Infrant, Infrant. It's like infant with an R after the F, Infrant.
Okay.
And they make... they're part of their Netgear ReadyNAS now, but they make really, I think, really high-end, nice stuff. That's what I've been using for some time. It's a Linux box, but you wouldn't know or care about that because you don't, with network-attached storage, you never have a keyboard or mouse or monitor. You just interface to it through the web. It's like your router. It has a web interface, and you administrate it that way. And I find them really excellent. They're gigabit, so they're fast. And the price really is determined by how much storage you put in it. So you could buy a bare empty, if you have some drives lying around, an empty network attached storage for $400 or $500 and then just pop disks in it as you can afford it. But I like the Infrant. And as I said, I bought it at Newegg and it was a terabyte was, less than 1,000 easy.
Not bad. What's the speed on that? As far as the write speed, read and write speed?
You know, your network speed is slower than the drive, so it doesn't really matter. It depends what drives you're going to put in. But you're going to use gigabit Ethernet, which is, I suppose you could use a faster connection, but gigabit is pretty fast. At gigabit speeds, it's just like copying to a hard drive. So, but the network is slower than the drive. That's the bottleneck, not the drives itself. So you could put in relatively slow SATA drives in there, and it'd be just fine. Another thing to look at, and this is kind of an up-and-comer, but it's not yet network well, it kind of is Drobo. I'm a big fan of the Drobo. $500 for the enclosure without drives. Now, one of the advantages of the Drobo is you can buy the enclosure and throw in any old drive you got. The Infront, the network-attached storage, the way RAID, it uses RAID 5, which is a way of protecting your data. It allows you to use multiple disks, but it has one little drawback. The size of the disks is determined by the size of the smallest drive you put in there. So if you put in one 80-gig drive and the rest are 500 gigs, the Infront thinks you have four 80-gig drives. That's the way RAID 5 works. It takes the lowest common denominator and multiplies it by the number of drives you have. The Drobo has all the functionality of RAID 5, but it doesn't care what size drives you put in. It just adds them all together. So the Drobo is designed to use with any old SATA drives you have lying around. And if you're a geek, it sounds like you are, James, and you've got a lot of old computers and drives lying around, you just throw them in. When I first got my Drobo, I put an 80, 120, 160, and I think I had one 500. Just threw them all in, and it works. It adds them up, and that's the total. You take out about a third for the redundancy, so you get two-thirds of the total storage you put in there. And then when it starts to run low, you just replace the smallest drive with a bigger drive. And as drives get cheaper, that's an easy thing to do. It's not network-attached storage unless you add Drobo Share. That adds to the cost. Drobo Share is a new thing from Drobo that allows you to do networking. Otherwise, it's just a USB drive. But if all you're looking for is external backup, Drobo is a really great solution. But then the Drobo plus Drobo Share, now you're talking $700. And you haven't even put any drives in it yet. So my suggestion, if saving money is important to you, go with the Infront is a pretty good choice. Our gadget guru, Ron Rosberg, coming up in just a little bit. But right now it's Cerie in Ontario. Hi, Cerie.
Hi, Leo. How are you?
I'm great. Welcome.
Hi. Well, I have a little problem here.
Yes.
My computer got the blue screen of death. And prior to that, it was restarting. And I had gone into the BIOS settings and then changed it so that I guess I induced the blue screen. And it said that there was a registry error. And I had tried about everything.
What did you change? What BIOS setting did you change?
Gosh, I don't remember. It was a while ago.
No, tell me, before you changed anything, it was rebooting how often?
It was like right when it prompts me for my password, it would restart again. It would reboot.
So you would give it the password and it would restart, or you would...
let me put in my password.
So it would get far enough in Windows that it would ask you to log in.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, it would just go boom.
Yep.
And it would restart.
Yeah.
And you thought,
I'll
go into BIOS and figure out what's wrong and something happened. And you know what? Nothing you did in BIOS screwed anything up.
Mm.
It was dying anyway.
Oh, God.
I think it's coincidental. Well, not necessarily. Oh, no. It may not even be a big deal. It, when it crashes at that point, it means that the computer started up fine, but there's some driver loading that's crashing. Did you ever try starting in safe mode?
It did not let me.
It would not let you into safe mode.
Okay. I also tried to take out I took out the drive and put it in another tower that I had.
Yeah.
And I set that as slave, and I could access some of the files, but most of my important documents are on my desktop, which for some reason I'm unable to access. And I think it's...
Oh, that's permissions. That's a permissions issue because you have to be administrator to do that. My suggestion at this point is back up your data. Do what you did. Back up your data, format the drive, reinstall. And I think you'll be fine. Stay tuned. I'll tell you how to get those files. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Train the
Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo's the number. We're talking digital. Digital anything. 8888 Ask Leo. Or you can Twitter me at Leo Laporte. Visit us in the chat room. Or watch us on video at twitlive.tv. Ron Rosberg, the gadget guru, is here. Before I talk to you, Ron, I just wanted to mention to our last caller, Sari, who was having trouble getting her files. She had taken, you know, her hard drive had crashed. She'd taken the old hard drive out of her system and put it in a new system as a secondary disk and was able to read it, except she couldn't access the files on her desktop. That's because you don't have ownership of those files. And I would put a link in the show notes, Sari, to a Microsoft tech note that will explain how to take ownership of those files. If you want to just search support.microsoft.com for tech note 308-421, 308-421. That's in Windows XP. There's also one for Vista. But it's a fairly simple process. You just have to tell Windows who's in charge here. Say, I own those files, not the previous owner, and then you'll be able to access them. Ron Rosberg, how are you today, gadget guru?
I am wonderful today. Beautiful sunny day.
Is it? Are you in San Francisco, or are you at Clear Lake, or are you in Palm Springs? Where are you?
I'm in San Francisco, heading tomorrow up to Clear Lake. And by the way, your room was demoed and gone.
Oh, no. Yeah, you blew it up, huh?
Yeah, the three things are good. We had a Las Vegas-type tower explosion.
You imploded it?
Right.
Like the dunes?
Yeah, right, it's all gone.
Well, you know, it's funny. I talked to somebody yesterday who's in Clear Lake who has a bed and breakfast based on old railroad cabooses up there.
Yeah,
do you know that one?
Yes, I know. It's over.
So I told him if Ron Rosberg ever blows up my room in Clear Lake, I'm coming over to you.
Yeah, it's in Nice. Yeah, it's right. It's on the other side of the highway on Highway 20 there in Nice, and
it looks really cool.
Yeah, pretty popular unit. But we're gonna do something nice up there. So I'm going to get started on building the house.
But you're not going to rent anymore. You're just going to live
in this. No, I still have three cabins there, Leo, at clearlake.org. I'm going to rent those rustic 1930s cabins 2 and 3, and then we'll manage.
You know what rustic is a code word for?
Yeah, well, no, they are rustic. They're a lot of people really like those.
They're cute, actually. I like them. I took a visit. They're cute.
Right.
So, what do you have for us, gadget wise, Mr. R?
Gadget wise today, I want to. First of all, by the way, give me an update because I heard you talk to a listener asking about the Rim 9000 or the Rim Bold.
Yeah, and when's that going to be out?
Well, I will tell you. This is my inside source, and take it from where you got it. They're saying that AT&T will have it in July, which makes sense after the introduction of the...
They're going to wait. Yeah, like I said, they won't wait for the iPhone.
This will be, you know, the iPhone, they really were not targeting to business people in the Rim. They will.
Right.
So it's supposed to be July, and then Sprint and Verizon are supposed to get it in September.
Okay. No T-Mobile, huh?
T-Mobile, I don't know about, but, you know, I would say T-Mobile... will be sometime here. I
could buy an unlocked one. See, that's one thing you can do with a GSM carrier, one that uses a SIM chip, is you can get an unlocked one and then put the SIM chip in, and it works just as if you'd bought it from that carrier.
Oh, by the way, my notes are, pardon me, T-Mobile's also September. Okay.
September, okay.
And the price is supposed to be like $300 on AT&T and $350 on...
I want one so badly, I can't wait. They look beautiful.
It looks really cool. I do. And I'm a BlackBerry guy, too. I love the BlackBerry. Yeah. Anyway, talking about gadgets today and some neat stuff, I love, as you know, the little Canon SD cameras, little pocket cameras and stuff. But a 3X, and I think they have a 5X, but I wanted to check out Panasonic has a new TZ5, Leo. It's a little bit larger than my SD870, not much, but the lens sticks out a little bit. But listen to this, a 10X optical. 10X optical. It's got a 28mm to 280, so it'd be equivalent like to 35mm, pretty much the same. And to be 10X optical, and by the way, for the listeners out there, forget about ever looking at cameras that talk about digital as far as zoom. Optical is your best zoom. Always get the best optical you can. But
absolutely,
if you want to be able, like, I go to Giant Games when I do go or whatever, and I want to shoot, have kind of like a telephoto, I have 10X on this thing, and the resolution is really, really excellent on this piece.
Yeah, because as good as your seats are, they're kind of far from the field, so having a lot of zoom really will help.
Exactly.
And even, you know, when you see the professional photographers on the sidelines at a sporting event, they're on the sidelines, they're right there, and they still have 200 to 400 millimeter zoom lenses. They want to get right in there.
This is a 9.1 megapixel They also make a 8.1, which is to the TZ4. But what I like, I've always been, when they came out, 3-inch LCD displays, and this is great. This has got a large 3-inch LCD. And why do I want a 3-inch? Because it's going to get, well, I'll tell you why, because I use it as a viewer also a lot of times.
Right.
To show people pictures. I can keep
One because it's a great party conversation starter. You take a picture of somebody and say, look at that. Isn't that great?
Yeah.
And I love it.
You pass it around, it's just having like a picture viewer with you. And this thing retails for $349. Up on Sasha's going to post up on the notes on Tech Guy Labs, today's notes, you'll be able to see DP review on it. They go really in extensively. I won't waste a lot of time doing that. I'm just going to tell you, if you're looking for...
I'm a big Lumix fan. I've had several Panasonic Lumixes. And in fact, I bought my first Lumix precisely because of that large LCD. I'm looking forward to seeing this one. That looks like a very nice camera.
Yeah, really like it. And I found it as low as like 218 or 219 on the internet. Now, be cautious. Make sure you find out the reputation on who you're buying it from and check them out, you know, and everything else. When I'll give you an example, I put in there anywhere from 218 to 349 price point, okay? Shop around and check it out. Always use your credit card. Don't ever send cash. The next item I want to talk about is looking for a network printer that's a little bit more heavy duty, because I'm kind of more of an office than really a home here. And I've had a lot of these 99 and 199 printers, laser printers, and they don't hold up real well. This is a 7500. It's Canon's. It's the MF 4695. Pardon me, 4690. The MF. It's the image class MF 4690. And retails for like $399. You can probably find a little on the net a little bit less. Great network printer, and some of the features on this thing, it's got built-in networking. You could scan your documents and send directly to an email address or to USB memory.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, so if you got, let's say, 20 or 30 documents and you want to put them on a stick and then take them over.
Mail it to yourself.
Well, yeah, exactly. It's fast. The pages per minute on this are really excellent. It's 21 pages per minute laser output, up to 1,200 by 600 DPI, and also duplex. I put in some sheets the other day, told it two-side printing, and it will actually, you know, if make a two-sided...
So it does that automatically. It takes the paper in, then it rolls it back and does it the other side?
Exactly. Has a 35-page automatic document feeder. And also what's really cool in this, you could actually forward your faxes directly to your email. So when I'm traveling, not knowing where I'm going to be, I can use this. I could have the faxes come in and put my email address in, and I could have those as a PDF and take them, you know, wherever I am, just off of my computer, you know, either Clear Lake or Palm Desert. It has USB 2.0. It's Windows and Mac compatible. You get 1,000 companies do this. On the starter cartridge, you get 1,000.
They give you a little teeny cartridge. It doesn't print.
Well, it's the same size cartridge, Leo. They just don't put as much ink in it.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, well, a lot of them are selling these things. You got to remember, 4 or 5
that's
years
where they make
ago,
the money.
A good printer was like $1,500 or $2,000.
That's true.
You know,
this is a laser printer. You know, I do recommend laser if you're going to do a lot of sheets.
Absolutely.
It's so expensive per sheet when you do inkjet, but a laser will save you a lot of money. So it's more expensive up front, but if you're going to do, it's for an office. If you're going to do a lot of printing, absolutely.
This is great for like a 2 or 3 person office. It's 250 sheet. You can put 250 sheets in and not the 50 or 100 a lot of printers have.
Yeah,
so if you're looking for a higher quality or faster printer, take a look at the Canon Image Class MF 4690. And the last thing I want to talk about is Verizon. By the way, you're talking about Clear Lake. We now have EVDO up at Clear Lake. Am I excited about that? I could be in my boat with my cradle point and have right in the middle of the lake, you know, high-speed internet, broadband access, you know, anywhere from 1,000 to 1,500 download and 700-800 upload. And I want to talk about Novatel makes for Verizon the USB 727 modem, which is that little small modem.
I have the Verizon USB Wi-Fi, EVDO.
Do you have the one that you could put a micro SD card in?
No, you could put a card in this?
Yes, you could put, so you can now...
What would you want more memory in this for?
Well, no, because you can use this as a backup stick.
Oh, I see. So it's a memory card and an EVDO modem.
That's correct. You can put a micro SD in it. And I think they're up to like almost 8 gigs now on a micro SD. So now you have an 8 gig storage card plus your EVDO. Now I will tell you one thing. I saw Engadget did the test on this. If you have the new Mac Air, This does not fit well with that. You've got to get a little extension cable.
Yeah, that's true for a lot of these things. The way they've made that USB port, you can't stick much in there.
I will tell you that Verizon, in this new pack I got, doesn't have that. I haven't needed it because most of my computers.
It's just a little extender.
This works really well with the cradle point. It's a great piece to stick on that cradle point, the little pocket Wi-Fi, the thing that you and I carry around. This is so small to use. You probably have like the 720. You have just probably the larger one.
I do. It's a Novatel.
Right. This is Novatel, too. Novatel makes a 727. Yeah. They make some great products.
I think for people with a MacBook Air where you have one USB port, there must be other computers like that where you have one USB port, having double duty on that thing is not a bad idea.
Yeah, no, absolutely. This is a neat little package, and retails for $299 on the internet with a 2-year contract. It's a $199 plus a $50 internet rebate. So you get it for $149. So you got your memory stick capabilities plus EVDO high speed Rev A. By the way, that's Rev A, which is the latest EVDO thing out there.
Great.
Yeah.
Very good, Ron. I thank you for your time, Ron Rosberg. He's the gadget guru. And joins us every week to talk about the greatest gadgets. Do you want people to email you and make suggestions?
Absolutely, sure. Ronald@USA.net. Ronald@USA.net be great. And I'll be up at Clear Lake next week talking to you probably for the next 4, 5, 6
Good.
Months.
Will you have the EVDO card, the Verizon, with you?
Yeah, absolutely.
We'll try it. We'll see if how Skype works up there.
Yeah, no, I will have that.
Good.
I test.
Can you go out in the boat while you're doing it?
Absolutely.
Go out in the boat. We'll do this show from the boat next week.
Okay, you got it.
Ron Rosberg, he's great, and he's got a great boat. If you ever make it to Clear Lake, get him to take you for a ride. Before we go from Twitter, a couple of questions I wanted to get to. Looks like Matt asks how to cool down his laptop. He says it's getting really hot. Performance is compromised, which is true. You could get a USB for about $10 laptop cooler. It's just a little device, plugs into the USB port, has fans in it, sits under the laptop. Really makes a difference. They're very inexpensive, highly recommended. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888 Ask Leo is the phone number. If you want to talk about high tech, we do it every weekend at this time. Tech Guy Labs website is techguylabs.com. We put show notes up there so you can find the links we talk about. You'll see a chat link there. You'll see video of me doing the show there. It's a little squooshed right now because we've moved to widescreen video, which is cool. 16:9 widescreen video. But that little window there is square. It's a 4x3. It's like the old style TV. So I have to figure out a way to get that wider. So I just look a little squooshed. That's all. Also, you can follow the video at twitlive.tv. It's unsquooshed there, 16:9. And there's a chat room there. And we have two chat rooms going. And I am taking questions from Twitter, which is really great. If you are a Twitter user, just send a message to @LeoLaporte. Helps if you follow me, just because I want more followers. If you're not a member of Twitter, just join. It's free, twitter.com. And again, I am Leo Laporte. One word, LEOLAPORTE. Leo Laporte on Twitter. Somebody says they want to send me an RS6000 mini computer for our television set. I don't know if we have room for it. Colleen's going, yeah, I want to hack one of those. Let's go to Bob in Oceanside. Bob, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. How you doing?
Fine, Leo. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
I bought a new hard disk that was much bigger than the one that came with the computer. The one that came with the computer was 200 gig. I bought a 750 gig, and it had one of those programs where you could do a disk copy, a backup
right.
of everything.
Right.
And it worked. I put that in, and it made a duplicate copy of it, and it booted, and everything works fine, except the remaining portion.
500 gigs.
Yeah,
invisible.
I can't get at it.
So what you did is you did too good of a duplicate. You duplicated the 250 gig drive Exactly, including the size.
Well, okay, but one other thing. The computer has the, instead of coming with Windows, it's Windows XP, instead of coming with the disk, it has a hidden sector or a hidden partition.
Hidden partition, yeah.
Right, and it's Recover Pro, I think is the name of it.
Right, and be careful not to mess with that.
Well, I think it may be part of that problem is that, because I went into the computer management and tried to...
Oh, good. That's what I was going to suggest. Right. You right-click on My Computer, select Manage, and then you could see how the disks are partitioned.
Exactly, and it shows 515.73 gigabytes unallocated.
Unallocated. So that's fine. That means that's available to you.
Well, except when I click on that, and I go through all the things that says, you don't want to format
partition it.
Yes, NTSC, all that stuff, yes. It goes through everything. Comes right down, says 100%, and goes blip, blue screen of death, reboot.
Ooh.
But everything works fine. And to me, anyway, it appears that there's something in the boot sector, something in there.
Let me ask you a couple of questions. When you run the computer management console, which is XP's built-in way of looking at the partitioning, does it see the hidden recovery partition?
Yes.
Okay.
It says,
sometimes those recovery partitions are so hidden, you can't see them.
Yeah, it says healthy, unknown partition.
Yeah, good. That's what it should say. Yeah. And then the extra space, does it say healthy, does it say a system, or does it say NTFS?
It just says unallocated.
Unallocated. So that means it's not even partitioned. So you can't format it yet.
Well, but...
You have to partition it first.
Right. When you click on it, it gives you that option, do the partition.
Oh, okay.
I say yes, and then you want to do it as a FAT 32, whatever you want. So I picked the big one.
NTFS, good.
NTFS. And like I said, it goes right through everything, right to the very instant where it comes back.
And then it crashes.
And I've done it a number of times. And to me, it appears that it's this Recover Pro or Recover, whatever that backup thing is. It must look at it to see that nothing has changed. And the instant that partition table changes, it says, oops, something's wrong. It reboots and it doesn't format that. Is there some way I can get like a new boot sector that would...
Well, you don't... I'm afraid of modifying... Who made the computer?
It was Fry's.
Fry's.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Compaq does this, Dell does this. They put hidden partitions on your system, and those partitions usually contain... Windows,
right,
and information about who made the system, so that you can't install another person. If you can't take their Windows recovery disks and use it somewhere else, you didn't get any recovery disks.
Correct.
So that's why you're quite rightly a little nervous about erasing that Recover Pro disk.
Well, that was one of the reasons I wanted
to do
a backup in case the old hard drive, crashed.
So you do have an image of the original.
Yes.
Ah, that's good news. That's good news. Because if you do damage Recover Pro, and I think modifying the master boot record would probably damage it, at least you could always get back.
Right.
Probably. I'm not promising anything.
I just wonder, is there a way of changing that boot sector so that it does not use the Recover Pro? Because I have the other one I set up.
Well, yes, you can. You absolutely can. And that's why I wanted to make sure that you have a way of getting back before you do this.
Oh, yeah.
You can tell Windows to do it with a simple command. You do it from the command line, fix MBR.
Fix?
And fix MBR, master boot record.
Uh-huh.
And by issuing that command from the recovery console, just reboot into Windows into the recovery console.
Right.
And type fix MBR, and then you need to say the device, which in this case is probably... Well, it's going to do hard disk zero by default, so just try fix MBR.
Right.
What that does is it rewrites the master boot record.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And unless recovery... See, what I don't know, and I should really look this up on the Recover Pro, I'm not sure what Phoenix is doing in terms of... They may be sitting in memory watching you try to... It sounds like if your theory is correct, they're actually sitting in memory watching you do this stuff. They may block even this. They probably would want to, because by doing so, you're going to disable Recover Pro.
Right.
But I would try it, since you can always get back.
Okay, now where was the recovery console, you say?
Yeah, you know where you go into safe mode?
Okay.
You press F8 as you're rebooting.
Right.
And you'll get many choices, including a command line. You go to the command line, you type fix MBR, all one word, F-I-X-MBR, and that'll rewrite the master boot record. I'm going to do some more research into this, though. Stick around. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Think about how much of your life is on your computer. Family photos, office documents, emails. 43% of people lose irreplaceable files every year. That's almost half. That means you're next. Think how terrible you'd feel if you woke up tomorrow and all that great stuff is gone. Well, a good day to you. Leo Laporte here, the tech guy, 8888. Ask Leo's my number if you want to talk about high tech. 8888, ask Leo. That translates out for the alphabetically challenged to 1-888-827-5536. And we are also taking questions via Twitter today. You can, if you're a member of Twitter, just use @LeoLaporte and I will see it. Still looking for, I'm not familiar with how this software works, this recovery software works that our last caller was talking about. So I haven't really been able to figure out exactly what it's doing. This is, I have to say, it's an unfortunate thing. And you see this almost paternalistic attitude of PC manufacturers. I understand why they do it, where they modify your system to for your own good, to protect you. It started, I think, some years ago with a thing called Backweb. Remember that? It was HP used to put these on their computers. It was software that would run in the background all the time and always be checking and see if there was any updates and would download updates, mostly updates to HP's own stuff. More and more companies started doing that, running things in the background to keep you safe. I have a gateway that's doing all sorts of little things in the background. I can't remember what it's called. It just bugs me. And then, of course, these recovery partitions, again, I guess their theory is, look, the less we have to spend supporting customers, the less we have to worry about saving customers, the better. And so if we put something on there like these recovery partitions with magic recovery software, we could tell them to push a button and we don't have to spend time on the phone with them. This was their response, frankly, to the fact that PC prices were going down, 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 and support costs were going up, 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 up. You can't have both ways. And we don't want to pay so much for computers, so what do? They offshore the support. They send it off to India. They also put stuff on your system that will automatically fix it. My biggest problem is it usually doesn't. It's usually of no use whatsoever, and it often gets in the way of somebody like our last caller who knows how to fix his machine but can't get around the fix-it software. Usually causes more problems for the advanced user. And I don't think it solves a lot of stuff, frankly. If you're an enthusiast, a hardcore enthusiast, one suggestion I have, Colleen reminded me of this, and I think this is absolutely true, is it's a great thing to have one of those boot disks that's based on Linux. It's just a CD that your system can start up from, running Nopix or Ubuntu. Nopix is a good choice. And it will boot up into it, and it helps you with diagnostics. Now, the problem is you can't make this once your computer is broken. So it's a good thing to make it now. One of my favorites is EBCD, the Emergency Boot CD. It's running on Linux, but it also has built into it a bunch of very handy tools for unerasing programs, fixing password problems, that kind of thing. It's free from ebcd.pcministry.com. I love the name, pcministry.com. And, it's a little old. It's perhaps not been updated in a few years, but it gets the job done. There are some Nopix-based recovery tools as well. But you should have, if you're serious about, if you're a serious geek, you should have one of these. EBCD is a good one to start with. It'll help you in a lot of situations, especially if you are like one of our callers some time ago, I think Kathy, one of those people that your friends call on for help. Having one of these is so useful. You go over with your disc. I usually go over with my little CD carrying case, and I'll have SpinRite in there. I'll have EBCD in there, a couple of antivirus tools, anti-spyware. It's always good to have a Windows install disk. You need, those are those are the screwdriver and hammer of the PC fix-it guy. Very useful to have. Max Headroom suggesting Nopix STD is another great boot disk. Not familiar with that one, but K-N-O-P-P-I-X is Nopix. And Nopix STD. A Google search would probably turn that up pretty quickly. So there are a lot of... I think these are the kind of things... Yeah, it's Nopix-STD.org. It's the security tools distribution. So it's got a bunch of security stuff on it. 8888-ASK-LEO is a number. If you've got a problem, if you've got a suggestion, if you've got some help for one of our callers, love to hear from you. And if we can help Bob somehow figure out how to recover those 500 gigabytes... You know, I mean, to be honest, what I would probably do, I'd erase the whole thing and start over. Since he has an image of the original setup that came with the system, just get rid of the rest of it. You don't need Big Brother helping you with your computer. Justin in Michigan. Hey, Justin, Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo. Congrats on Twit Live, by the way.
Thanks. You like it? You watching it?
Yeah, I'm watching right now. I've been watching it since the beginning. So,
how's the picture for you?
It's doing really good. It's iffy at some points, but it's better right now, a lot better.
We have about 2,500 people watching, and so what happens is more and more people go on, it uses more and more bandwidth, and then our service provider, Stickam, which is, thank you, Stickam, they'll tune it up. They'll add more servers, they'll add more bandwidth. So sometimes it might go bad and then start going bad, and then it'll get better again.
Yeah.
So I'm glad you're watching it. Twitlive.tv is where you can watch it. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I said it'll just get iffy for a couple of seconds, and then it'll get better.
It's not so much for the radio show, because we want you to listen to the radio show, and, you know, you can get it on XM, and there's stations all over the country, and there's, of course, many internet streams of it as well that you can listen to. We certainly want you to listen to those, because that's the stations that keep this show alive. But during the rest of the week, when it's just me, please watch twitlive.tv. We're doing about 25 hours of programming all week long. But go to school. You still have to go to school, Justin.
Yeah. I actually have a couple of questions, but I'll start with my biggest problem.
Okay.
I have a 2-year-old about Dell Inspiron E1405.
Mm-hmm.
And in the last couple of weeks or so, the screen will just go blank. Like, I'll just be typing and it'll go blank. But it'll be like...
Now, okay, I have a question for you. When you say go blank, is it really blank, or is there an image still on there? Like, if you go out in the sun and you shine light on it, can you still see what's going on?
Well, it's weird. It goes colors. It'll go like light gray, or it'll be light blue, or it'll just go black.
Okay.
And the only way I can fix it is to reboot.
Rebooting does fix it.
It does fix it, yes. And then it just happens randomly. While I was waiting for you to answer, it happened again. So it's really ironic. But.
So it just flickers. But now, see, the rebooting puzzles me, because at first I was going to say a hardware problem. You know, it's very common. Laptop hinges... You know, you're constantly opening and closing it, and there's a little ribbon cable that connects the screen to the rest of the laptop. And, of course, every time you open and close it, that ribbon cable is getting bent. And eventually, it's not uncommon for them to lose a pin or two or break. Fortunately, it's a very inexpensive fix. But that's a hardware problem. Rebooting shouldn't fix that.
Yeah, it fixes it. And it's not just a flicker. It goes blank, and it won't fix itself until I reboot. It's weird, but that's what helps.
Couple of things I would try. Of course, always when you have video problems or you have unknown crashing, it's always a good idea to check and see if there's an updated video driver.
I did. You'll have to. Everything's good.
Okay, you got the latest from Dell.
Yeah.
When you get a laptop, you got to always get the drivers from the laptop manufacturer, because they often mess with stuff. So, all right, you went to Dell, you got the latest drivers. You might want to turn off. Any power management in there? I'm wondering if maybe power management is...
I have that all turned off for, like, going on standby and all that. That's all off.
Oh, you got a mystery there.
Yeah, and I was also having trouble with when I closed it. If I don't close it all the way, it'll go black, and when I open it up, it won't. It's the same thing. I have to reboot. So it may be with me closing it. It doesn't happen when I close it, though. It's really, really randomly.
Yeah, no, it would be random because it's just, you know, it's just kind of like the connector is just very marginal and, you know, tapping it might do enough. So, and rebooting it might be enough just to kind of shake it around a little bit. So it doesn't necessarily mean that it's not hardware. Rebooting it may just be, you know, kind of another way. And maybe a heat-related issue, you know, rebooting, even though it's pretty quick, is enough time for the processor to cool off for a little bit. So it could be related to that as well. I'll be honest with you. I don't know what it could be if rebooting really does truly fix it. I don't know. Because what that tells you, if rebooting the machine fixes it, is it's software. It's something is, you know, has a very common source of problems of this kind, problems that happen after you use something for a while, something called a memory leak, where the memory that is used by the application goes up. Application allocates memory, asks for memory from the operating system, says, give me some more memory, I need some more, and never releases it, forgets. It's a forgetful application. Give me more memory. I forgot I got some. Give me some. And pretty soon, it just uses up all the memory. That can cause problems over time. You know, Firefox is kind of notorious for doing that. Firefox 2 would grab more and more and more and more and more memory until it crashed. It just eventually it just crashed because it was just eating up so much memory. I don't think that's what's going on with you, but I'm puzzled. I to be honest, I don't know. You stumped me, Justin. Keep listening. Somebody will call. If you got an idea, visit us on Twitter. That's another way. In fact, Jenny says it could be the backlight. That's my first thought, Jenny. That's why I asked if he goes out in the sun, if he could still see the screen. If the backlight goes out, usually on an LCD, you'll still see an image. It should be very faint. And getting some light on that screen reflecting off of the LCDs, you can often see. It's almost like those old passive displays that didn't have backlights. She also said that the power inverters go bad quickly with Dells. She's replaced hers twice. So that's something to look at. It could be. That would, you know what? That could be it. Jenny, you might have helped Justin right there. Jenny was on Twitter, I should say. Jenny Rose on Twitter. Thank you. And Max Headroom, Jason, I should say, has another suggestion. FLAC, for PHLAK, for a recovery disc. I haven't heard of that one. PHLAK. All right, we're going to take a break. Come back with more of your calls. Got Chris Marquardt, our photo guy, too. Coming up, I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 88 Ask Leo is the number. Got some suggestions. Daniel had a very good suggestion for our last caller. He was having trouble with his Dell laptop screen. He said, hey, just plug in an external monitor and see if it happens. If it does, then you'll know it's a video card or a driver, not physical hardware, not a bad ribbon cable. Of course, what was I thinking? So if your laptop has the capability of plugging in an external monitor, this is for Justin in Michigan. Just plug in the external monitor and see if it still happens. If it does, then it is a video card problem. That's probably most likely what the problem is. Maybe a driver issue. If it doesn't, then it's got to be the cable connecting the LCD screen or a problem with the LCD screen failing. Also, thanks to Nightwing, who says a couple of months ago, a caller, this is via Twitter, a caller who was a Toshiba user had problems with a black screen when sleeping. It'd go to sleep, but the screen wouldn't light back up when you woke it. He says, apparently that was a known problem with those Toshibas, and they have a BIOS update to fix it. So if you have a Toshiba laptop that won't wake from sleep, you might want to look at a new a BIOS update. That might solve the problem. Back to the phones we go. Mark is on the line from Arizona. Hi, Mark. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo. How you doing?
I'm fantastic. How's the weather in Arizona right now?
It's a cool 100, I think, 102 maybe.
Is it already 100? Holy cow.
It's really fine at 100. It's not a problem. It's 114. You got a problem.
Right. It's so dry. Yeah, 100 isn't as bad as it is here. Yeah.
So I have a laundry list of stuff because I've been listening to you for like 10 years and never got a chance to talk to you before. But hopefully I can ask you a couple things. Yeah. So the first thing I was going to ask you, maybe you can help me. I'm running a WordPress blog for, I do political organizations, do websites for political organizations.
Fantastic. And, that's great.
And so one of the things I'd like to be able to do is have them post HTML, you know, to that, to the blog, right?
Right, right.
And, you know, I haven't found anything. There used to be something called Posty, but it doesn't work anymore because I was stupid and upgraded everything. So
you're saying that you want your contributors to be able to post in HTML?
To the blog, right.
To the blog, not you as an administrator. Of course, as an administrator, you can do anything you want in a WordPress blog.
Yeah, and I mean, there's programs out there that allow you to do it, but everything that I've tried doesn't work very good. Posty used to work pretty good, but
see, I'm puzzled because I use WordPress and I can embed any arbitrary HTML into my posts. You're saying that they can't use, you know, bracket in their posts?
Well, they can do it in the, I'm talking about emailing. I want them to be able to send.
Oh, I missed that little extra part there. Okay, you want them to email their posts to you.
Exactly. I want them to be able to email HTML documents and have it work. It used to be able to use Posty, but that no longer works.
I would, first of all, I would check what version are you using, the latest version of WordPress?
Yeah, the latest version, yeah.
I would check. WordPress now does allow you to email files, email posts into it. It gives you have to use a dedicated address for it want to keep secret, obviously.
Obviously.
Okay, and so you're saying that when you do that, it strips out the HTML.
Well, it does a really bad job. Is the problem? So the post.
Well, okay. Now this is the problem here: is that you don't want it to do that with standard HTML emails. Try, just see if you can send it text with HTML in it, if that works. I think that's what you need to do. You send it an HTML email, that's a whole nother kind of kettle of fish.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. In other words, just tell them, hey, you can't do HTML. But the problem is, it's the level of user I'm dealing with. See,
I understand. You want to make it easy for them. I understand.
Yeah, the idea here is to make it just basically bulletproof, you know. What can I say?
Yeah. Yeah, it's always a challenge. I'm trying to think now. And why is it you want... I have to say, it's risky to allow them to put arbitrary HTML in there. There's a security risk involved with that.
Well, you know, WordPress tries to strip it out. It just does a really bad job.
Well, that's why it does, because it's concerned about your putting that stuff in there. So why is it you want them to be able to do that?
Well, because it's the challenge of, you know, I live out in Sun City, in the Sun City area.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what the scoop is, but apparently when you hit a certain age, something happens and you just don't like new things anymore.
I hope that never happens to me. I don't know. It sounds like the worst thing in the world. I pray that doesn't happen. So, no, I understand that you want to make it easy for your end users, but letting them put arbitrary HTML in their posts, especially if they're technology challenged, is a recipe for disaster. For instance, an unclosed tag can make your entire blog a link to one site.
Yeah.
I'll be honest with you. I would suggest that WordPress is doing the right thing by preventing you from doing what you want to do.
Okay. Well, I tell you what, I've got another question to ask you,
I'll figure out a way. You know, there are ways to do, for instance, things like text style or markdown, these kind of pseudo HTML where you allow them to do things like bold and stuff that's safe. And that might be the way to do it. And there are markdown and text style plugins for WordPress that will make that safer. That may be the way you want to go on that.
Okay. I'll look into that. So I got another question.
Real quickly, I got about 30 seconds left.
Okay, first of all, I've never heard you mention a high energy Ethernet converters and all your discussions, dialogues with Wi-Fi people. I'm just curious about why you never...
Don't know anything about them. I've never mentioned it because I don't know. I'll do some research. Coming up in just a... We're out of time. I'm sorry to say. I got to take a break. But coming up, our photo guy, Chris Marquardt. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. This portion of the Tech Guy is brought to you by Nod 32 Antivirus. I protect all my PCs with Nod 32 for your free trial version. Visit eset.com/Nod32. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. He is Chris Marquardt, the camera guy. He's a digital photography whiz, the host of the Tips from the Top Floor podcast. And he joins us every week from his home in Germany to talk about digital photography. Hi, Chris. How are you today?
Hello, Mr. Laporte. How are you?
Oh, I am wonderful. I am enjoying life. I like this time of year.
I heard you bought another expensive lens, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you're getting me in trouble. My wife's listening. Honey, I had to. Actually, I bought two expensive lenses, both the same kind, but one for my video camera and one for my still camera. I went wide. You know, I've noticed lately that a lot of photographers, you know, traditionally, I think people always think of a slightly telephoto lens, like 105 millimeter, as a portrait lens.
It is easier if you have, photography is in general a bit easier if you have a longer lens, because that'll help you close in on things.
Yeah,
you don't have any subject to kind of place in the picture.
But see, I'm hanging out with these pros and they're all shooting wide. And it's kind of, if you look at National Geographic or anywhere where there are a lot of great photos, I notice wide is kind of in right now. So yes. I got myself, and it's an expensive lens, but I have to say it's a lot of fun. And you're right, because it takes in so much, you can tend to get very cluttered photos. You have to be very careful.
Yeah. So which one did you get?
Oh, I don't want to admit it. I got the 16-35.
I got the 17-40. I'm going for the 16-35.
Really? That seems like that wouldn't make much difference. 17, 16.
Well, yours is 2.8. Mine is a 4.
It's fast.
It's really fast.
Now, well, I noticed some interesting things. It gets distorted on the edges, you know.
Yes, it does. Yeah. The lens has to do a bit of almost a miracle to get all this in and still be a good quality. And and with a full frame camera, yes, you can almost see the tips of your feet when you take a picture.
If you go all the way to 16, it's not quite fisheye, but it's wide. But what I like, I've been using it at parties. What's neat is you get, it's almost a Norman Rockwell effect where you see little stories in multiple parts of the picture. So you see this couple over here and this group over here, and you see the relationships between all the people in it. And that's something you can't do. You know, with a telephoto, you kind of focus in. So let's talk about that. Where should people start? What should they get? What's kind of gravy? What's kind of a necessity? That kind of thing.
I get this question like every day. I get emails, people asking me, what lens should I buy? And then there's never an easy answer. So let's go through a few of them. The cameras, the digital SLRs that you buy nowadays usually come with what's called a kit lens. It comes with it. And usually it's an 18-55 millimeter.
Pretty wide range zoom.
It's a normal medium range zoom that will get you going, but those are usually not top quality. So if you invest in something, glass is the first thing you should invest in. Not a new camera body, get better glass. That's for sure.
That's what the fancy photographers call their lenses. They call them glass.
So there are.
That the 5D, of course, is like several thousand dollars, but it comes with a 24-105 zoom, that kit, and I think it's a pretty good zoom.
That is a pretty good zoom.
Yeah. And that's a nice range. 24 is pretty wide. 105 is nice for portraits.
Yeah. Some people ask me if they should get like an all-purpose walk-around lens, like a huge focal range, let's say 24-300 millimeters.
No.
That does come with a price tag, but not just a price tag in terms of buying it, but they're usually not as contrasty, not as bright. They don't let as much light through. They have more distortion, barrel distortion, pincushion distortion.
So you don't get something less, for nothing. You're going to pay the price and quality.
Exactly. More, well, less edge sharpness, more vignetting.
Somebody told me if you get a zoom, and maybe it's not the greatest zoom, not to take pictures at the minimum and the maximum. That's where their quality is the least.
I think we talked about this last month. The sweet spot.
The sweet spot. Yeah.
Somewhere in the middle. Oh, you're taking pictures there. I can hear
a picture of you. Yeah. Well, it's of a camera, but that's where you would be.
So for wildlife photography, it really depends on what you want to shoot. Wildlife photography, you obviously need a longer lens. You don't want to get too close to the animals, not to scare them away.
Right.
So there we're talking about something in the 200 millimeter and up range.
Right. My friend Scott Bourne is a bird photographer, and he'll shoot 600 millimeters.
He's got real guns there, yes.
He has to, because your bird's not going to let you come up close.
Right. And then if you want to shoot stuff like, let's say, architecture, landscape, you might want to go for something a bit wider, maybe 24 millimeters or something. But then there's also landscape photography that can be done with longer lenses, like if you want to compress the depth on something, like those layered mountainscapes and things like that. Some of those are done with pretty long lenses.
One thing I notice is that every lens has kind of its own feeling.
Yes. And that's actually a pretty good exercise. If you get a new lens, like let's say you get a 24 millimeter, stick a sticker on the zoom ring just to leave it on one focal length to remind you to not zoom and use that one focal length for a whole day to get used to that feeling, because our eyes don't give us that sort of an angle, basically.
Now, one thing I should mention is that all the lengths we're talking about real lengths, not what's maybe written on the barrel, because it depending on how big the pickup is on your camera. If it's what we call a full frame 35 millimeter pickup, then a 24 is a 24. But if it's let's say it's very typically the 1.5 size, yeah, they're slightly smaller. And so you multiply by 1.5 and then a 24 is really a 36 and a 50 is really a 75. So you have to know what your multiplier is for your particular camera. And this is SLRs also we're talking about, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I mean, you can get like a wide angle adapter for a point and shoot camera.
Okay.
But here we're talking SLRs, yes.
It's nice to have the range. I mean, if you could afford it, it's nice to have the full range.
Oh, yes, yes. But I would never cover that full range with one lens, because you really pay the price in a different way.
And, what about my favorite, the fixed focal length 50 millimeter lens?
that is kind of the normal lens. Actually, that is that's a good exercise to use that every now and then. I sometimes go out and have only 50 millimeter on, and that's all I do. And that really
that's a challenge, isn't it?
It is a challenge because
you can't zoom. You got to walk in and out.
No, but the other challenge is with a wide angle or a telephoto lens, you always get this certain effect that really will add something to your picture. Wide angle will always look sort of cool. With a 50 millimeter that looks so normal, you will really have to work it in order to get an interesting picture.
I think that's a good point. That's a very good point. Yeah. How fun. I tell you, there's so much to know technically in photography. And then, so what we do is, by the way, we alternate. So this was our technical episode. Next week, we'll get creative again. But you need to know both. And in a way, the technical stuff, like what lens you're using, is the support for the creative stuff. So you need to have that.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, I love it. It's so much fun. Is this the kind of thing you learn in the workshops?
As well as creativity, as well as composition, as well as how to compose a picture with a wide angle lens to not really get the clutter in there.
Yeah.
And stuff.
I need that. I can't wait. I'm going to the San Francisco one. That's sold out. Sorry. There's also one that's sold out in Colorado, right?
Right, that's sold out. Then we have one coming up in Nashville. We'll be going out to shoot at concerts, at venues, event sort of photography. And then one in Portland where we'll do studio photography. And we have actually have four independent full studio setups there with with wireless triggers, where we'll be able to shoot in different groups independently of each other. We'll have cool backgrounds and reflectors and soft boxes and beauty dishes and all those cool toys.
So that's Portland, Maine, by the way, not Portland, Oregon. Yeah. And you can find out more about all of this if you go to discoverthetopfloor.com or just go to Tips from the Top Floor. That's where his podcast is and where you can find a link to the workshops and a lot more. That's tipsfromthetopfloor.com. Chris Marquardt. Oh man, I just one thing I like though about my life is I'm not a pro. There's no stress. There's no burden. I don't have to produce. I don't have to get that perfect wedding shot. I can just go out and have fun. And thank goodness, because 99% of what I take, garbage. If I had to do it for a living, I'd be in deep, deep trouble.
I'm not going to tell you how big my keeper ratio is.
Yeah, well, sometime we should talk about that. Because
the
when
secret
I was
of the pros is to only show your best work.
right. There's a really, really broad range. When I was in the trip to Tasmania, there was a guy who's used to shooting with a big 4x5 camera and a big film camera, expensive film camera. So Charlie Kramer only shot maybe 1,000 shots in 2 weeks, 100 a day, which sounds like a lot, but it's not a lot.
It's not.
I shot 3600, and that was about the same as my hero, Bruce Dale, the National Geographic photographer, was with us. But then Peter Krogh, who is also one of my favorite photographers of all time, is just a brilliant photographer and extremely creative. He shot 12,000.
Wow. So,
and I wouldn't say he got more great shots than anybody else. I think, you know, it's just he likes to experiment.
Different style.
Different style. All right, Chris. Hey, we got to run, but I do thank you so much. And we'll talk again next week about what is becoming my favorite subject, digital photography. Thank you, Chris Marquardt.
Sure.
And don't forget his website, tipsfromthetopfloor.com. And if you want to go to his camera seminars, his photography seminars, his workshops, discover thetopfloor.com. You know, Chris was talking about the fact that you work within a lens. The sweet spot of a zoom lens is neither the extreme telephoto or the extreme wide. Somewhere kind of in the middle. That's where you get the crispest photo. And I thought about something that my friend Scott Bourne, who's a pro photographer, also told me that I was stunned to learn. Is it's the same for ISO settings. Now, many cameras, many point and shoots now, and certainly all digital SLRs, you can set the, what we used to call ISO. You know, when you'd buy film, or they used to call it ASA even. Remember, you'd buy film and it'd be 400 or 100. It was how sensitive it is to light. They still call it ISO on a digital camera, but really what you're doing is you're amplifying the signal from the pickup chip. So as you turn up the ISO, the better it is in low light situations. You go to 1600, or on some of the newer cameras, you can even go to 3200 or 6400. The Nikon D3 does really well, even at very, very, very high ISOs. It doesn't get grainy. But Scott told me, which is interesting, that the optimum ISO setting isn't necessarily the lowest. I just always set my camera at ISO 100, turn it all the way down. He said, no, in fact, depends on the camera. Most Canons, for instance, the optimum ISO, the optimum light sensitivity is not the bottom 100, but 200 or 250. So I'm now shooting with my 5D at 250. I'll put a picture on the website. I just took a big wide-angle shot of what I see sitting here in my chair as I do the show, and I'll put that up on the website in a bit. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo. That's my number. If you want to talk high tech, just a few more minutes left on the show. But don't forget, all week long, I do the same thing, only even more geeky, at twit.tv. That's the website for my podcasts. We have about 10 of them, covering everything from geek food to geek parenting to security, Windows, Mac, tech news, all of that stuff. And you can watch it video as well as audio. The audio is available from iTunes. The video is at twitlive.tv. We're getting better and better at the video. We're still not there. We're still working on it. We've still got some more things to implement, but we're getting closer and closer. Twitlive.tv. As I mentioned, you can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com. Follow Leo Laporte, all one word, LEOLAPORTE. And then you're able to send me messages via Twitter, and we're doing that as well as a way of giving you another way to get in touch through the show. This is good. This is good. Mr. Glass is on the line from New York City. Hey, Mr. Glass, Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hello?
Yeah, how you doing?
Good, all right. So I've been having a computer issue with my computer for a while. I actually have two network cards, one to take in the internet for my college and one to push it out for Wi-Fi. Because mm-hmm. the Wi-Fi they have doesn't really work.
Mm-hmm.
And about 4 or 5 months ago, it started that when I was doing high transfer speeds, it would actually blue screen my desktop.
Wow.
And over time, that's degraded. I'm now at about 150, 200 kilobytes, and I die.
Okay. So that's probably a heat-related issue. Anytime activity...
it's fine. I mean, my processor is running at nothing. I've looked at the memory stats, and it's like... nothing is taking up anything, and it'll.
Okay.
At one point, then I got it sort of.
If
fixed,
it's if you're sure it. Everything's cool, and that is when the machine gets busy and things start happening, you know, crashes and blue screen stuff. Usually, I look at heat, but now since you say it's specifically with network access, the other issue could be a memory leak or a stack overflow at the TCP stack in particular. What version of Windows are you using?
XP.
Yeah.
Pro.
Yeah.
I mean, it's. I would say that there is, if you're sure that it's not heat.
I'm sure it's not heat because it really is just when I do these high transfers. And I'm going into high transfers on the network card out to the internet. Like, I'm doing the video to you just fine. But if I booted up my Mac Mini in Mac, and it just connected to do the auto updates, and it killed my computer.
And, oh, that's interesting. So it's not just it's not just Windows, it's your Mac too?
Well, it's that it's going over anything that goes on the transfer on the internet kills the computer that's serving the internet.
Everything's going through that computer.
Yeah, everything goes out.
Oh, I get it. Okay. I was going to say, why would your Mac affect it? I get it now. So the Mac is getting its internet access from the computer.
Yeah. I'm using internet.
You're not using a router at all?
I am using a router. I killed the router, and it got slightly better for about a week and then started dying again. I started looking into it. I looked at the dumps, and I killed my antivirus. Now I don't have antivirus. And it actually, would freeze. It would lock up. And I really started looking into, memory issues, memory leaks, heat. And my computer isn't doing anything. It's all powerful. It's running at almost none of its capacity.
So it's probably not heat. Almost certainly then it is. It could be your network interface card. In fact, I'm almost certain it's your network interface card has a bug in it. Possibly in its firmware, its buffer is getting overflowed and then data is going somewhere else and it's crashing the system. That's why you're getting a blue screen. It's possible that it is the operating system or software running on the operating system, but I'm going to bet your network interface card. I would say almost certainly what you want to do is either swap out that network interface card just to test it or get a new one. Earl in San Bernardino, Leo Laporte. We were talking at the beginning of the show, Earl, about MySpace and that terrible story about the woman was accused of basically encouraging a young girl to kill herself. You have an input on that, Burl?
Yeah, well, what I wanted to say was simply that in time progression, we go from generation to generation to generation. And right now, we are in what's called the millennium generation. That's the millennium generation that's becoming adults.
There was Gen X, Gen Y. And now this is the millennium generation.
That's right. We went through, obviously, the baby boomers, X, right. Gen Y. We are now in the millennium generation.
Yeah, that's my daughter. She's 16. She was born in 1992. She's part of this new millennium. Absolutely.
The new millennium generation. Yep. All I wanted to say was, with this millennium generation, we're going to find that they are much more socially oriented, much more community oriented.
Isn't that funny?
Which gets back to MySpace. Yep. Facebook.
Why do you think I would agree with you 100%? Both my kids are very social, and it seems counterintuitive to those of us of an earlier generation, as obviously you and I are, Earl, because we say, "But wait a minute, you're not even talking to these people, and you may not have even met them in real life, and yet you have this relationship." But I would agree with you 100%. But why do you think it is this millennial generation is so social?
Well, it follows a sequence. It always goes in a sequence, repeats over and over and over and over again. You can go back to the beginning of our country and follow one generation, war.
Is it a pendulum?
It's a continuous cycle. Time is not linear. Time is spiral. So this is coming around again. We've gone through the war generation. We've gone through the us generation. You remember?
That was me. Yep, yep.
That was you and I are the same one.
Yep,
we've gone through the X generation. That generation, which is really which could be in office. Look at what we have now. We have a silent generation. That's McCain running for the presidency. Mm-hmm. We have a consummate baby boomer. That's Hillary Clinton running. And who do we have? We have Obama, who's right at the cusp of Generation X. Three different generations. And guess what? Your children are the millennium generation. All I wanted to say was, with social systems, there comes responsibility. So you being the adult needs to teach, as I would, social responsibility.
I agree.
When it comes to our youth and the internet, because that's what's going to build the next generation.
It's our job. I agree with you, Earl, 100%. I think that's a great note to end on. I'm running out of time. Earl, I thank you. I think that's a really good point. And as adults, we can't blame the kids for what they're doing on the internet. It's our job to teach them. And boy, it's a hard job because we didn't grow up with the internet. It's something very new to us, but that's why I do this show. So we can talk about it, so we can understand it, so we can use it, and we can teach our kids how to use it better. I thank you so much for being here. I'm out of time. I do want to thank Luis Oliveira on the board there and Gina, who's running the phones. I thank all of you for being here. We invite you to join me on our podcasts at twit.tv, T-W-I-T.tv, all week long in our live broadcast now. Our video, our little TV station at twitlive.tv. I'm Leo Laporte, the tech guy. See you next week. Bye-bye. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy. Thank you for listening to the podcast. If you'd like to hear the show live, check your local listings or visit our website, leo.am, for a list of stations where you can hear the Tech Guy radio show live on the air. You can also hear archived shows at leo.am and subscribe to our podcast there, or open your podcasting client and subscribe to the feed at leo.am/podcasts/KFI. Thanks to Howard Bailey for the music for this podcast. You can find more of Howard's work at soundclick.com. Thanks to Premier Radio Networks for syndicating the show. Most of all, thanks to you for listening. This is Leo Laporte. I'll see you next time on The Tech Guy.